are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1974, Dennis Lynn Rader stalked and murdered a family of four in Wichita, Kansas. Since adolescence, he had read about serial killers and imagined becoming one. Soon after killing the family, he murdered a young woman and then another until he had 10 victims. He named himself BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill, and wrote notes that terrorized the city. He remained on the loose for 30 years. No one who knew him guessed his dark secret. He nearly got away with his crimes, but in 2004, he began to play risky games with the police. He made a mistake. When he was arrested, Rader's family, friends, and coworkers were shocked to discover that BTK had been among them, going to work, raising his children, and acting normal. This case stands out both for the brutal treatment of victims and for the ordinary public face that Rader, a church council president, had shown to the outside world. Through jailhouse visits, telephone calls, and written correspondence, Catherine Ramsland worked with Rader himself to analyze the layers of his psyche. Using his drawings, letters, interviews, and Rader's unique codes, she presents in meticulous detail the childhood roots and development of one man's motivation to stalk, torture, and kill. She reveals aspects of the dark motivations of this most famous of living serial killers that have never before been revealed. The documentary BTK, Confession of a Serial Killer, premieres January 8th and 9th on A&E. The two-night event sheds new light on Rader's double life as both an upstanding citizen and a heartless killer. Dr. Catherine Ramsland, the renowned professor of forensic psychology and author, leads the examination of Rader's transformation from an American boy to an American monster who wreaked havoc in Wichita, Kansas, and went uncaptured for 30 years. With exclusive conversations with Rader himself, eye-opening new archival, comprehensive interviews, and access to Rader's drawings and coded diaries, all paired with Dr. Ramsland's expertise, viewers get to know the man behind the moniker, the truth behind the headline, and a glimpse at the secrets Rader is still holding on to. The documentary we are discussing tonight is BTK, Confession of a Serial Killer, with my special guest, journalist and author and professor, Dr. Catherine Ramsland. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Dr. Catherine Ramsland.
Always enjoy being here. Thanks for having me.
It's always a fantastic pleasure and a great thrill. Thank you so much for this. Let's talk about the origins of this documentary project, how it came about. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it started with the publication of the book, and then we began to look for people who might be interested in making it, you know, visual. And we had several takers. We sold the option a couple of times, and then the pandemic.
Right.
The pandemic was a pretty big interruption because we did have somebody who was going to do it. And then A&E decided that they wanted to do it as a four-part documentary, which that's pretty daunting. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of work involved. But in the end, the director's vision and the vision of all the production people really came through in terms of the goal I had for the book. And I thought that was really quite an achievement because my goal is kind of academic. I really wanted this to use what a serial killer has to say about himself to benefit law enforcement, criminal justice, and forensic psychology. So it wasn't just a serial killer blathering on. It was formed for a specific purpose, and the documentary achieves that, which I'm very pleased about.
We're talking about the book that 2016, and that book is the Confession of a Serial Killer, The Untold Story of Dennis Rader, the BTK Killer, again, released in 2016. And the audiobook edition is going to be from Blackstone Publishing. It will be released January 11th. So let's get to this very, very important book and very important project that you undertook with Dennis Rader. Tell us a little bit about some of the people that were, including Jim Thompson, some of the people that were involved in the very beginning of the book that you say that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Well, right from the start, it wasn't even my book. What had happened is Rader was arrested in 2005, and a woman whose code name we ended up using, we called her True Grit, had decided to write this book and contacted him, and he agreed to do it with her. And they had several years of correspondence, and apparently she had decided she wasn't going to do this book. It had been a lot more difficult for her than she imagined it to be. She had been under attack a lot from, you know, all, because she was kind of the gatekeeper for Rader. Mm-hmm. And I saw her on Facebook and asked her whatever happened to her book, because I had heard about her through news reports. And she asked me if I would take it over, which was not as simple as it sounds, because that was that. And it was an easy yes for me, because I had already written a book about how mental health experts over the past century had spent a lot of time with extreme offenders to learn about their development and their crimes and their attitudes, et cetera. So I already had a template, and it was a great opportunity, but I needed to be approved by this consortium of the victims' family members, their surviving family members, because they wanted to have some control over the kind of thing that would be put out there. They didn't want anything out there,
right?
But certainly what something was going to be, and they wanted some control over it, and as well as benefiting from it, which was fine with me. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a proposal. I sent it to the attorney, Jim Thompson, for the families, and told them what I wanted to do. And they did like what I wanted to do. They liked my credentials in, you know, in the academic world in terms of teaching forensic psychology and being very prominent in the research arena for serial killers and mass murderers. So they liked all that, but still, it was a long, drawn out process. And during this time, I also got to know Rader, who wasn't so keen about transferring all this from the original person, mm-hmm. who he really liked, to someone he didn't know. So we ended up playing chess, and he also wanted me to solve a series of codes, in part because he liked to communicate with codes, because he thought of himself as kind of a spy, and it was also a way to keep prison guards from knowing what he was saying, doing. But also, it was a test mm-hmm. for me to see, would I play the code game? And of course I will, because my interest in him was the whole picture. Who is this guy? What motivates him? How does he create these codes and respond to them? And so fine. I mean, it was actually pretty intriguing to be sent these weird codes to see if I could figure them out. And I needed the other person, True Grit, to help me, because he had sent part to me and part to her, and, you know, kind of a Zodiac thing. Everybody get together and figure this out. So, but for me, that was all behavior. I was interested in everything that he would do, whether it was manipulating, lying, telling the truth, whatever. It didn't matter. I wanted to see all the layers.
In that as well, that you talk about these layers that you wanted to see, what are some of the things that he told you about influence from other serial killers and some of the fantasies that it seemed that he shared with some of these role models?
Yeah, a lot of that came along the way. We worked for 5 years on this book. Initially, he, of course, talked about what everybody knows, that he, who's read anything about him, that he had role models, H.H. Holmes for his his torture castles, and Rader would put his torture fantasies into a barn because he's from Kansas. Mm-hmm. And also Harvey Glattman, who would bind his victims with ropes, because for Rader, rope was a pretty significant fetish object in his own fantasies. So those are the two that many people are aware he uses role models. But along the way, as we were talking and reading and looking at comparisons to others, you know, he honed some of that and got interested in some that he didn't know about before, and talked more about some of the readings he had done. And it was pretty clear that most of what he did wasn't really original to him. He had gotten it either out of true crime magazines or fiction. Mm-hmm. He had read about what some serial killers had done in novels. And so some of the things he was doing was trying to replicate all of that. So he wasn't really that imaginative. And, you know, unfortunately, in fiction and film, we get this notion of this mastermind mentality, you know, the great puppeteer, manipulator. And most of that just isn't what these serial killers are like. Mm-hmm. They're just out to achieve their goals and get it the way they need to get it. So he would find ideas in these various sources and try them out.
He used a lot of, again, he didn't make this easy for you, and you had to collaborate with the initial contact to be able to do any of this and figure out a bunch of things, because you mentioned his trying to be clever. But you talk about him talking about the victims and talking about the murders and using expressions like going into the cookie jar and meals. So explain that language that you deciphered that he uses.
Yeah, that was probably one of the very first things that he did, was send me clippings from newspapers and magazines with things circled. And then he would write a letter, sometimes a 20-page letter, and his handwriting is pretty terrible. And he'd embed in the letter along the way the clues to what he had circled. So I had to make my way through the letter and then look back at the clippings. And, like, for example, one of the most puzzling to me was when he talked about my interest in recipes of the three-layer kind. And I thought, well, I don't cook. Mm-hmm. What is he talking about? But then I realized, as I saw what he circled, would have a B, a T, or a K. And so I realized, oh, that's the three-layer thing. And subsequently, I learned about his magical number three. He thinks the whole world is sort of organized around threes, and that threes had somehow protected him. And so he has this attunement to threes. So there was that, and then he had some metaphors like castles and trains and such things as that. But it became unwieldy. I mean, we'd be talking along about, you know, using trains and canyons and passengers and whatnot, as we were talking about whether this book was even going to sell or not, because I did have a lot of issues with that. And then when the book did sell, I decided I would make the metaphor the codes that we would use. So it's kind of an irony, because he did not want any woman kind of dominating him in any way. That was one of his key issues, is how females threw him off balance. And there I was making the code, but I used threes, and I used the cave and all the stuff that was appealing to him. And also, he sometimes would forget what some of his codes meant. So, wow. You know, so this way we had a record, you know, that we could both refer to. But in the end, the irony is that I framed the book through my codes, using what I knew would be his preferential style.
Mm-hmm. You had already done with your book, The Mind of a Murderer, you already had extensive experience dealing with extreme offenders. How did that help you in this regard with BTK?
Well, The Mind of a Murderer is really looking at what others had done. So I wanted to look at accounts not by detectives or journalists, but by mental health experts to see how they had approached extreme offenders, mass and serial killers. So that wasn't really my work, although I've certainly approached other offenders, but not to this degree, and not to the degree that those professionals had done. So they really gave me role models in terms of the persistence, the kinds of things you had to put up with, the way to approach somebody who's very egotistical or narcissistic. And I also had trained, I have one master's degree in clinical psychology that has a specific type of training of really bracketing your preconceptions and your biases so that you can listen and let that person's world be what it is, rather than you imposing, you know, some theoretical perspective on them, but just listening to them. So I already had really been solidly trained in that approach. And that's certainly the one I used with Rader and would use with anybody else, is what is your world? It doesn't matter if it corresponds to reality or corresponds to morality. It matters that you yield to me what your experience is, what your perspective is, and how you came to be this way. So that's, I learned from looking to others as well as my own training in clinical psychology.
Now, an important part of this is when you asked him the crucial or important question about his torture fantasies. How did you approach that, and how did you ensure that you were going to get something accurate?
One of the things I did was to collect what I knew from others. And I knew that I was already friends with the DA on that case.
Right.
So she wasn't keen about me doing this, but she was won over and she showed me her whole stash of stuff. I saw the interrogation, the whole police interrogation notes. So I had the way he presented himself to them. I had letters from the first person. I had letters from other people. So I had this multiple perspectives on him in terms of the way, you know, he'd spin doctor really everything for, you know, whoever he was talking to.
Right.
So this way I had, you know, if he wanted to talk about torturing animals, for example, I already knew some things that I knew he didn't want to tell me. So then I could call him out on it. But I didn't call him out on it in a confrontational way. I would simply say, oh, well, you know, you told them this, so you're telling me something a little different. How do you make sense of that? And he'd sometimes get upset if we were on the phone, but then he'd write a long letter justifying everything he had said. And again, for me, that's behavior. It's not necessarily that I'm after the truth, because really, you can look at any of us. We all form our narratives to serve our purposes, our sure. belief system. So I'm looking at how does he approach being confronted? How does he approach being told, well, I know that you also tortured rabbits. What is he going to do with that, since he didn't tell it to me, but I knew about it?
Right.
So it really was, and again, you're looking at a very extended investment of time, which very few people can do. And you know, psychologists, they charge, and nobody's paying them for this kind of time. So you have to see this as an opportunity, the way I did, and be willing to take the hit in terms of the investment of time and money. And I was, because I really believe in this kind of work. I think it's very valuable and beneficial. It helps us to, it prevents us from seeing the serial killers as all collected under a profile or a sort of a cookie cutter approach. And I think that's a mistake that I'm hoping this book can rectify.
What did the late Dr. Al Carlisle contribute to this? How did he help, and in what area?
Oh, Al Carlisle was so terrific. He's such a loss. Mm-hmm. He was a Utah prison psychologist who had interviewed Ted Bundy when Bundy was first picked up on suspicion of burglary and then attempted abduction. And Carlisle had been at the prison, and he'd given him a number of assessments. He wasn't the only one. There was another psychologists or psychiatrists who put him through a bunch of things. But Carlisle's task was to decide if Bundy might be a danger if he were released. And so he did a lot of work. He interviewed a number of people who knew Bundy and really, again, gave us a very nice profile, or I mean, not a profile, but an approach to how do you look at someone like this? You can't just go with what they say because they're going to put themselves in the very best light. And Bundy was a master at that. Right. So Carlisle had not just done this assessment of Bundy, but he also had interviewed a few other serial killers while there. And so he came up with this idea of how are they able to pass as if they are like us and yet have this very, very dark, awful side to them, and then not have any remorse and et cetera. So because he had come up with this very interesting description of a compartmentalized person, I asked him if I could show this to Rader, as I wanted to see Rader's response to it. Because one of the things I was trying to do was get Rader to not just say what he knew, but to look at what other people had said and reflect on that in terms of how it applied to him. And he worked hard at it. I have to give him a lot of credit. When he saw Carlisle's analysis of Bundy as being like an actor taking on a lot of different roles, he said, yeah, that's very, very accurate. That really captures it. But then he responded with what I thought was even more interesting than what Al gave me, which was this idea of cubing instead of compartmentalizing. Because when you think about like compartments on a shelving unit, for example,
right,
it's as if they're all distinctly different and almost unrelated to one another. It's just a bunch of different personalities, and similar to an actor, they take on different roles, but those roles aren't related to one another.
Right.
When Rader came up with his metaphor, which is cubing, it's the idea that all the faces are there, but you only show one face at a time in any given circumstance. So if you need to be the good father or good husband or churchgoer, you show that face. And then, but if you see someone you want to stalk, you immediately can switch out. Because all the faces are part of you. They are all connected and associated to you. And because people like Rader are not emotionally rooted in the notion of integrity or truth or morality, they can make that switch very easily. They're really mentally dexterous in terms of being able to adopt a different persona for a different circumstance. So to me, not only is, you know, cubing easier to spell than compartmentalizing, I think it gets at it better. And I kind of wish I could have talked with Carlisle about that, but he of course has passed on. And I think he would have really appreciated that metaphor because I think it works very well.
When you talk to BTK, Dennis Rader, he mentions this mythical figure, this Minotaur, and he calls it the Minotaur sense. Tell us more about this mythological symbol that he uses to describe.
Okay, I think it's Minotaur.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm not sure, but
you could be right. You're probably right.
Yes. Yeah, the Minotaur was a code name for serial killers. So he'll talk about the Kansas Minotaur, or he'll read about somebody, like there was a guy in South Carolina a couple of years ago who got caught, and he'll call him the South Carolina Minotaur. So that's just a way to be able to write about this in letters without guards confiscating it. You know, because I've had a few letters sent back to me by the prison. You may not do this, you may not do that.
Wow.
They have to always be careful about the whole contraband angle. Mm. And so I think he adopted that. But also he had read about it in a novel, and he liked the image of that, of this beast that's inside this maze that's fed these innocent virgins. And, you know, he liked that to use to describe what a serial killer was like. And then for him, that would be a cave monster. And he thinks that these cave monsters are part of him. Not like he's demon possessed. That was a That was a narrative he initially had used after his minister had visited him and, right. and said to him, the only way I can make sense of this is if you're demon possessed. Right. So Rader grabbed onto that. He does that. He immediately absorbs things that make sense. And then for a little while, he'll use the narrative. But he doesn't any longer think of it that way. But he does think about that there is this monstrous part of him that he himself doesn't understand well. It's really compulsion that comes from his fantasy life, from a very vivid fantasy life in which he's highly invested for his identity. So he has more control than he often will say. But the Minotaur image or metaphor appealed to him in that way.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity right now to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in diets of women age 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. But Ritual didn't stop there. They invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. The results? Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. My wife Lisa started taking Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin over 2.5 years ago. She was impressed with how taking the Ritual multivitamin made her feel. I decided to take Ritual Essential for Men 50 Plus when it became available. And it's been about a year now, and I'm convinced Ritual has made a significant difference in how I feel every day. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, we're talking about some of the things that Dennis Rader used and utilized to describe some of the things, his fantasies to evade censorship through the prison guards that would read this material. So there was an underlying reason, but also he was being clever and getting you to work a little bit. What about, which was really the crux of what you're doing, to try to find out what his psychosexual development was when he was young, how murder and sexuality got all mixed up, and hence all of these fantasies and this murderous rampage. So tell us a little bit about what you discovered.
Well, one of the difficulties of working with him was he was really a minutia collector. Mm-hmm. And so many of his early letters were long, long, long descriptions of his family history and, you know, things that really had no bearing on what I was trying to do. But I had to be patient and certainly show interest. And finally, he suddenly realized this book was the book for him to get his story out. Right. This is going to be the definitive one, and he might never have this opportunity again. And all of a sudden, the letters just turn many shades darker in terms of the things he wanted to explore. And part of that was he had dug through a lot of the papers he keeps in his cell, and he had found original police reports. They were summaries of police reports. And he sent them to me all marked up with what they got wrong and what this meant and what that meant. So here's the whole description of when they went into the Oteros, what they saw, and he'd then elaborate on what did that mean. And that's basically how I presented in the book. Here's the report, and here are the things that he had to say about various aspects of this report, or about his experience of stalking a particular victim, or what did he do afterward and how did he feel afterward? So it was like all of a sudden he felt the pressure of a deadline.
Right.
Oh my God, I have to get busy because I want this to be my dark journey. And all of the other stuff that was about his family dropped away. But he then began to start thinking about where does this originate? He talked a lot about his boyhood. And then it was up to me really to look at the themes of that and see how they related to the potential development of the kind of dark fantasies he had that then really led the dance for him. So it was really kind of him figuring out he needed to do some work and me finding through this, I mean, lots and lots and lots of detail, the things that would be useful for my goals. So the hard thing about doing a book of this length is all the data you amass and keeping your goals always in front. So you know what you're focusing on, but not to the point where you're working with tunnel vision or you know, a cognitive bias that limits the world. So I had to watch my own expectations and what I was hoping to see. But also I needed to guide him away from all the minutia. Like one of the earliest letters he sent me had a journal of his day. And it was like minute by minute getting up at this time. And this is what they gave me for breakfast. And then I did this and then I did that. And he kept one for every single day, thinking someone was going to really find this to be very important.
Yeah.
He's just sitting in a single prison cell. He's not in general population. He doesn't interact with anybody. You know, he'll read, he was at the time he's listening to the stock report because he had imaginary stocks and listened to the farmer's reports and whatnot. But it was up to me to make my way through all this data and see the things that were really going to make this into a book. And there, I will admit, there were times I didn't think I had a book.
Really?
Yeah. Because I didn't think he was up to it. And then all of a sudden would come letters filled with very rich ideas and memories and reflections. And like, okay, now I can move forward. But I'd say for the first 2 years, I wasn't sure.
Mm. You're trying to get him to be insightful about his own life. And you say this is a guided autobiography. So you had to help him be able to learn and decipher some of the things that have happened. When he got to his development, when he talks about his childhood and some of the things that, again, seem to turn are directly related to his sexual fantasies, what did he tell you about his early childhood and bullying and the barn? Tell us a little bit about some of the things that he finally divulged to you about that.
Yeah, I mean, he would always kind of go to what had excited him. And even very young, it wasn't necessarily sexual, but it was certainly physical.
Right.
And so he would talk about that. But I will say, like, at one point, he told me about a movie. Now, he had a thing with his mother. She was a brunette, and she had kind of movie star looks, as many people described her. And he would go to the movies with her, and he told me he had the movies he had watched. So I watched them. To get a sense of that little boy's perspective sitting with his beautiful mother. Right. And there was one, The House of Wax. Oh my God, it's a naked woman bound in this thing. She's brunette, naked, struggling in all the most titillating ways. Oh Lord, it's a good thing I watched this rather than just heard him say, we watched The House of Wax and that had an effect on me. Mm. Well, I can imagine it did because he already was thinking about binding girls who made him feel uncomfortable or took away his self-esteem. He was thinking of binding them in railroad tracks or building girl traps for them. And so here he is with his mother, who's already humiliated him once, and he's seen her stuck, helpless, and he's seen the look on her face that made him feel powerful. And now he's watching this movie with a clearly, I mean, that's showing obviously full frontal nudity back in those days, but oh, the suggestion of it was very strong in that movie.
Right.
And I thought, whoa, that right there, that's the kind of thing. And the werewolf who can shapeshift, that's the kind of thing. What's a little boy thinking about after he's seen, not just seen these movies, but they haunt him. He has nightmares. He has dreams about them. He thinks about them. And how is that affecting the kinds of fantasy life he is going to develop as he enters into puberty? And it does become all about sexual arousal. So he had the sexual arousal as a boy, getting tied up, playing the cowboy games, and he got trapped once in a silo and it was scared, but also it was really exciting. Mm-hmm. So he had some of those experiences early, to the point where he would tie ropes around his waist because it felt good. And as he's developing into a sexual being, it feels very good. And it's the kind of thing he's not going to give up.
Yeah. You also talk about innocuous things, or seemingly, like the Dudley Do-Right cartoon that we all watched.
Yeah, well, I mean, for Raider, immediately it was tying the redheaded girl on the train track. And
right. It
wasn't about her getting rescued. It was about get that train to hit her and run her over. So that she was bound and helpless, though, was the thing. And then as a 14-year-old, he found a True Detective magazine that had the Harvey Glattman pictures on the cover and saw this image of this utterly helpless, bound woman who was about to be murdered. And he masturbated to that. That was highly exciting to him. And we do know that when certain stimuli are paired with masturbation as a young boy is becoming a young man, that becomes part of the sexual fetish. It might be something that lasts the rest of his life because it gets paired and it gets fused together with the process of sexual development. And for him, that was the image he wanted to replicate in his own victims.
So he graduated to stalking. Initially, that was his first foray into criminality, was the stalking?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, he went into the military and he was in other countries. And I think he did a lot of voyeuristic activity at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then that became stalking. So the voyeurism was looking into people's windows, imagining power over them. And then as he would see someone, he might follow that person. So I think the voyeurism came before the stalking. But then the stalking arrived with the idea that he would kidnap somebody. And he did make an attempt to kidnap a bank clerk, and it failed utterly. And he got scared that he was going to get identified. So he began to break into houses. And when he did that, it made him feel very powerful over the people who lived there. I mean, often they weren't home, but just he would take something like a hammer, or, you know, whatever, just because he had invaded their space. He owned the place. He had a position over them. And so that then became he's not going to try to capture someone and kidnap her. He's going to go into a house and subdue the person he wants. And then that leads, of course, to the Otero murders.
You utilized for this documentary, but also for this book, letters and drawings that he had sent you. Explain what might be on this document, what will be on this documentary regarding those letters and those drawings.
Yeah, I mean, I have thousands of pages of his handwriting, and you know, God bless the documentary makers for going through all that to pick out passages, but there will be passages highlighted. We also interviewed him and recorded it, so you'll hear him responding to some of my questions.
Wow.
Highlighted passages of things he said that are either ironic in terms of how could he not see the how this makes no sense in the polarization morally in the same person. You'll see drawings that he's done. For example, he drew for me his what he had hoped one day to build was a silo filled with torture instruments similar to H.H. Holmes and his castle.
Right.
And so it's very meticulous, full color. And, you know, he said to me, it wasn't, he really had not wanted to do this because it took him back into a world he knew he had to avoid. And yet you look at all the detail, you see how much fun he had doing it. He did right. want to do it. He wanted to do it very much. And so that's the interesting dynamic I had with him is he had a verbal narrative. And he's kind of like Ted Bundy in that thinking when he says something that controls reality, right? Language right. controls reality. And Bundy was very much like that too. But then you see that he's presenting one thing and he's showing in his behavior something altogether different. For me, that's the most interesting and intriguing aspect of him is how does he not see? How does he develop these blind spots, these walls between what he says about himself and what he's showing about himself? Well, we all do it. It's a human right. tendency, but in a serial killer, it's particularly interesting.
It's much more profound and seems much more out of touch from reality. Despite being a fairly intelligent person, it would seem that there's this out of touch with reality completely, even at this time, even after this many years.
Right.
There's not a recognition or realization by him.
And that is the role of a very rich and real feeling fantasy life. That's where he comes alive. That's where his whole identity is wrapped up in the fantasy person. And so it's very easy for him to develop these blind spots and these walls between what's real and what he thinks is real, because he's so immersed in who, you know, this image of himself. Again, a human tendency. And at the end of the book, I talk about this. It's not that he's such a different creature, but as you use the word profound, he's profoundly different in some ways, but all of those ways are attached to who we all are to some degree, but he just doesn't have the emotional rootedness in wanting a sense of integrity, of presenting. You know, a lot of us want to present ourselves with uniformity. Whatever I do in this situation would come through in a different situation because I'm who I am. That's often how we think of ourselves. That isn't the way someone like him operates. It's whatever I need for this situation is what matters, not presenting myself in the same way all the time.
Was there any reaction from him to say that as he discovered things through this process that you asked him specifically questions so that he could learn to be able to respond in the way you would like him to respond? Rather than just talking, you say that lots of his thinking was convoluted. What was his reaction to some of this, if there was, some of this discovery of the connection, the psychosexual development? Was there any recognition that he had learned something from this? And what was that reaction?
Yeah, I mean, hasn't read the book, by the way. He has no response to that because it's contraband.
Right.
But yes, he had... There's a chapter in which it's really his thinking about himself, to some extent guided by assessment instruments that I use, but he's thinking his way through, where does this all come from? What's salient in his memory and his reflective process that he keeps coming back to him over and over? And he makes lists, but he does do it. And also I used a few books like Adrian Raine's, I think it's Anatomy of Violence, that helped him frame it out. Al Carlisle's ideas helped him to articulate things that he hadn't really been able to understand. But in the end, he did his own self-analysis, which I thought was, you know, to some extent insightful. I mean, he's not a particularly bright guy. He didn't do well in school, mm-hmm. but he certainly worked at trying to understand this. And of course, I will hear from people saying, "Oh, he's just screwing with you. He's manipulating you." Certainly, he's manipulating me to some extent. But I think everybody wants to try to understand themselves, particularly sure. narcissists. And I think he did want to take advantage of the fact that he had someone here with credentials, with a sense of structure, who could possibly guide him through some of this. And I think I guided him through some. I don't know that I have the whole truth and nothing but the truth, but I have a lot from him, for which I think he deserves some credit.
Well, it's an extraordinary book. It was extraordinary when I interviewed you in 2016 about this book, Confession of a Serial Killer, The Untold Story of Dennis Rader, the BTK Killer, which was released in 2016. And now the audiobook edition by Blackstone Publishing will be released January 11th. Just tell our audience, before I let you go, about the A&E two-part documentary, Confession of a Serial Killer, a BTK Killer. Tell us just a little bit about when that will air and, when that will air on A&E.
Okay, on A&E, it's actually a four-part. It's two nights, but four parts.
Ah.
It's an arc over the whole story. But there's a lot more in it than just what's in the book. We found people to talk to who had more to say. And also there are, like, I did not interview the victims' families. So we do have some of them in the documentary. I did not interview the impact on people in Wichita because I was doing an autobiography. So there's a lot more about Wichita, the effect of a serial killer in town. It's on A&E, January 8th and 9th, four parts, so 2 hours each night. And I personally think that it's multifaceted. There's a lot there that you may never have heard or read before about Dennis Rader.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Catherine Ramslin, for coming on and talking about first, your book, Confession of a Serial Killer, The Untold Story of Dennis Rader, the BTK Killer, and also the documentary, BTK, Confession of a Serial Killer, premieres January 8th and 9th on A&E. Thank you so much, Dr. Catherine Ramslin, for this interview. Thank you so much, and have a great evening.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Thank you. Good night.